It's on. Okay. So, the topic for tonight is the emergence of non-Orthodox Judaism in England. We've discussed already Germany and Austria, the Czech lands. We even touched a little bit upon Hungary, although we'll do that more in the next few weeks. What about England? So we actually discussed it to a limited extent last year when we did Moses Montefiore. But in England, reform began in schism. Unlike in other parts of Europe, where reform was a gradual process that happened within a community that retained its unified structure, in England that was not the case, and it could not be the case. For generations, ever since the reemergence of a Jewish community of England from 1656 and the days of Oliver Cromwell and Menashe ben Israel, the community had never been all that religious. It had always been a relaxed community in terms of piety. But that laxity was tolerated. It was tolerated even by the more traditional Jews, because everyone was Orthodox in light of there being no alternative. In England, there was great respect for the Hebrew Bible. And those who tried to criticize rabbinic Judaism, possibly as part of an attempt to convert Jews to the Anglican Church, their way was to belittle the Talmud and belittle post-biblical literature. So from a standpoint of weak-kneed Jews who are looking to defend themselves from the attacks of outsiders, one of the ways they can do that is by strengthening the biblical character of their own religiosity and downplaying the role of rabbinic literature. And so the Talmud is not as important, the Bible is more important, and I will base my Judaism primarily on the Bible. Can you do that? Well, you can try, but it takes you away from traditional orthodoxy. Okay. The official leadership of the British Jewish community was doing nothing to satisfy the yearnings of progressive Jews, and for that matter, doing nothing to make Judaism palatable to a next generation who were more acculturated. Solomon Herschel was the chief rabbi from about 1802 to 1842, and he never learned to speak English correctly. He was a German rabbi who, his English was improper, to say the least, and he was not someone to go out into the community and do kiruv, do outreach, to bring people closer to faith. He was satisfied to stay in his library and read his books all day, and be a Talmud Chacham who gave two drushes a year, Shabbos Shuva and Shabbos Agadol, in the traditional style. But he was doing nothing more than that. That was his job, and that's it.
Wasn't that the way it was done in Europe?
Yes. However, in a traditional environment where your average Jew, and for that matter, the average younger Jew, is still firmly rooted in observance and in communal life, it's okay for the rabbis to be aloof and just paskin shilas. But in a community where acculturation is taking its toll and people are drifting basically to the periphery of Judaism and beyond, you would think it's the responsibility of the religious leadership to do something about it, to try to reverse those trends. And if he doesn't, well, shame on him, maybe. Yeah. Understood, because religion is just a formality. Okay, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, in 1800, how many British Jews were really British? Where did
okay,
the British Jews
come
so from?
The answer to that is, before the arrival of significant numbers of Eastern European Jews in the late 1800s, starting from 1881 and beyond, the community was fairly acculturated. Yes, there were some people who were coming from the Germanic lands in the mid-1800s. However, the bulk of them came 100 years earlier, and were a combination of Ashkenazim and Sephardim, with the Sephardim having the early dominance from the Spanish-Portuguese community. But these are very British people. These are English speakers who are part of the commercial life of the country. They don't have full emancipation yet, because there are certain aspects of elite life that are still forbidden to them, like you can't have a Jewish member of the House of Lords or the House of Commons until later in the 19th century. But they're on their way towards full emancipation. These are people who are not ghetto Jews by any stretch.
How many Jews were there?
In 1840, there were approximately 60,000 Jews in England. Okay, so...
You all have any significance?
Yeah. Yeah.
Just, I missed a few classes. Just fill me in a little bit. What was the main difference in the landscape between, let's say, German Jewish... German Jewry and English Jewry. In a dumb sketch, you know.
The most important difference for these purposes right now is that in Germany, the role of seeking emancipation, that aspect of yearning for emancipation and having it not yet within grasp, is a factor in leading to heterodoxy. Leading people to develop other styles of Judaism that show, that display their citizenship, their desire for civic participation. And also, in Germany, you have Jewish scholars of some renown who are typically leaning towards a reformist tendency. But yes, whereas in England, you don't have that at all. You have amoratsis, you have total ignorance. And all their rabbis were imported rabbis. Okay. So, in the 1830s, there were attempts to modernize the services in the synagogues. There were petitions by certain progressive elements for Bevis Marks, which was the Spanish-Portuguese shul, and the Great Ashkenazi Synagogue, to adopt reforms along the lines of the Hamburg Temple. Those petitions were rejected. However, as a token display of accommodation, there were measures taken to eliminate the downtime in the service. Certain mishaberachs, the sale of honors, some of the more grotesque and commercial aspects of synagogue life were reduced in deference to the wishes of the progressive elements. However, that's not enough to make people happy. Yet the biggest issue was not so much theology or even the liturgy. The biggest issue was geography. The synagogues were based in the East End of London, where the early Jewish settlement was. But as people got wealthy and lived in the posh neighborhoods of West London, they needed a synagogue that serviced their needs. And nobody wants to drive in a horse and buggy on Shabbos. It's a shanda, you know. You have to walk to shul on Shabbos. And so there was a request by the Mokata and Goldsmith families, who were intermarried, one Sephardic, one Ashkenazi, but they were cousins to each other because there were a lot of intermarriages between them, for a branch of the main synagogues to be established on the West End. This was refused. So in 1840, by the religious establishment of both Ashkenazi and Sephardi synagogues, because there was a fear that if you allow people to have a branch synagogue, they'll do there whatever they want. And the ecclesiastical hierarchy wants to preserve their absolute monopoly and control over everything. There's this real fear of, if we give an inch, they'll take a mile. Or if we... I don't know. I don't know. The Shabbos.
No, okay. You always have those restrictions. You always have a breakaway.
Yes, so it's inevitable that something is going to happen. So in 1840, they established the Reform Club. And this Reform Club was designed to have some synagogue service that would combine Ashkenazic and Sephardic rites, although geared more towards the Sephardic, which was seen as more decorous and more prestigious, so that these intermarried families, Ashkenazi-Sephardi families, would be able to pray together. That was one of their real concerns. They don't like the idea of ethnic division between Jewish elements of the Jewish community on liturgical lines. Let's get rid of that, scrap that, and have a unified prayer book, which is a nice idea, okay? If you can pull it off, which they did.
When you say reform, it's not reform movement, but reform within Ashkenaz and
Sephardi. Well, we'll see. They end up calling themselves Reform with a capital R. With a capital R. Okay. So this club included Horatio Montefiore, the brother of Moses Montefiore, which led Moshele to be very upset with his brother and to excommunicate him and cause horrible ill will within the family. Moses Montefiore, as we discussed last year, was staunch in his support for a sort of a rigid orthodoxy. Not that he was always in his life an extreme pietist. He was a traditional Jew. It's just that he believed that any theological breakaway or departure from tradition was sinister and not to be countenanced in the least. Okay. So this group at first did not want to have their own synagogue. They wanted to be a branch of an existing one. When that was refused, they recognized we have to make our own shul. They need a rabbi. They turned to Isaac Marcus Yost, who was a Jewish scholar, historian in Germany, one of the early scholars, early 19th century Jewish historians who wrote important works, and he was of the reformist bent, and he tried to find them a rabbi, but he couldn't find one who was willing to serve a progressive synagogue in London. So instead they hired David Wolf Marx, who was a 29-year-old fellow of limited theological training, whose claim to fame was that he was a Torah reader in Liverpool, and that he refused to lane on the second day of Yontif because he didn't believe in it. So that was his progressive bona fides, was he wouldn't lane on the second day Yontif.
That was his credential.
Yeah, that's... Now, with a name like David Wolf Marx, he must have been Niyake. Okay, so he produces a prayer book together with Hyman Horowitz, and in this prayer book there are certain curiosities, and you tell me what you notice about these curiosities, what they have in common. There was no bracha on Hallel, there was no bracha on the Hanukkah candles, and there was no bracha on the Megillah. Why? So, what's wrong with the Rabbanans?
They're biblical.
It's not in the Old Testament.
He's a Torah-based person.
Right.
I didn't say he didn't light the Hanukkah candles, and I didn't say he didn't read the Megillah. I said no bracha on those things. Correct. Asher kirishanu mitzvosev etzivanu lekroes ahalil almikra Megillah. So we're thanking God, we're blessing God for having commanded us in certain things that the Bible never said. So it's a lie. Now, how does the traditional rabbinic viewpoint defend these brachot? So the famous Rav Avia, Lo Tasur, the law of the Lo Tasur, you're forbidden to depart from the ways that the sages instruct you, so therefore, by default, every rabbinic commandment is a pseudo-biblical commandment, and thus the Asher Kedishanu passes muster. But he didn't go for that. Okay. What other changes did he include?
Look what I did.
No, there was a lot of sincerity involved here, and I'll explain. Okay, no Kol Nidrei, but we've seen that before. No Av HaRachamim, why? Because it's a vengeful prayer. No V'lam Malshinim, also a vengeful prayer, and can get you in trouble with anyone who claims to be the target of that prayer. No angels and demons in the davening, so none of those funny paragraphs in between the Yivarecha Hashem V'Yishmarecha and the Birkas Kohanim. Could be also no Shalom Aleichem, yeah. And in general, a shorter service. One thing that they add is a solemn recitation of the Ten Commandments. Is that allowed?
Why not?
Because the Talmud says it isn't.
Yeah, but we're not following the Talmud.
Okay, so what is Talmudic law about the Ten Commandments?
They had separate seating?
Yeah, no. They had separate seating. Yes, they had separate seating. Okay, so the Ten Commandments was originally part of the Shema. It says so in the Mishnah and Talmud, and it was part of the temple service, and it was even potentially part of the service in the provinces, but was outlawed because of the Taromet Taminim, because of the claims of the sectarians. Which sectarians? It's not exactly clear. Probably the early Christians. And Rashi explains, and the Yerushalmi explain, what was the claim? That only the Ten Commandments were given by God to the Jewish people on Mount Sinai, and the rest of the Torah is a forgery of Moses. So in order to disabuse people of that notion that the whole Torah is bunk except for the Ten Commandments, they outlawed the public recitation of the Ten Commandments so as not to elevate that higher than the rest of the Bible. Where do we run into a little trouble with that, even today, in Orthodox synagogues?
We stand
on Shavuos and on Parshas Yisro and Parshas Vaschanan in many synagogues for the reading of the Ten Commandments. So Rav Moshe and Rav Avadi Yosef, all in the poskim literature, discuss whether or not that's a legitimate practice. And Rav Avadi breathed fire against it. He said, it's wrong, you can't do it, because the Rambam said it's wrong. Rav Moshe said, in those places where you do it, you could do it, but you shouldn't institute it if it wasn't the existing practice.
Where is it not the practice today?
I think it's Sephardic synagogues. I don't know.
Ashkenaz at art school at the end of after davening.
At the end of davening as a private individual, but not as a part of the public service. Now, you could ask, well, that, there was a heresy back then that people only believe in the Ten Commandments. But does that heresy still exist today that we should have to worry about these things? Maybe, you know, times have changed that we can depart from the Talmudic concerns.
Jews, ten is too much already.
Okay, so I'll tell you a story that I read in the archives of the Committee on Jewish Law and Standards of the Rabbinical Assembly in JTS. This is in the 1950s. It's a great story. Young rabbi comes to a new conservative synagogue out on Long Island, a suburban synagogue, young rabbi, and he thinks he's a little bit on the frum side of things. And so he goes to the high holidays, to the honors committee, the service committee, and he tells them who's going to get what aliyah. Erev Yom Kippur, Mrs. Goldberg comes banging on the rabbi's door. Rabbi, my husband didn't get his Aliyah card for Shlishi, for Yom Kippur. He gets it every year. We know we give a lot of money, too. She says, sorry, Mrs. Goldberg, your husband's not getting an Aliyah this year. We have a new standard. You have to be Shomer Shabbos to get an Aliyah Yom Kippur. Ooh, Shomer Shabbos. So she says to him, Rabbi, you don't understand. Not everyone is so pious like you. I only believe in morality and the Ten Commandments. So the rabbi says, I'm sorry, Mrs. Goldberg, but the Shabbos is in the Ten Commandments. So, it's a true story. I read it in the archives.
You said, you showed him the mitzvot tav. He wants to expunge that because he didn't believe
it. Right, right.
Today, in Reformed Jew, maybe
Racha, right.
Or a conservative, do they include Asher Mishra?
Sure, absolutely. Yeah.
They do.
Doctrinal considerations like that are not nearly as important today as they were 170 years ago when people thought about these things. Now, if you, people don't think about these things, they just do. They read the liturgy. That's it. Okay. Now, what else was a curiosity in this synagogue, this West London synagogue? The Kaddish. The Kaddish was read in what language? Wrong. And wrong.
German.
Wrong.
Hebrew.
Kaddish in Hebrew? You ever hear of that? So I understand Aramaic. It's the original. They didn't tinker with it. Or in English because it's a British congregation and people speak English. But why Hebrew? Because as I said, in England, they were bibliophiles. They liked the Bible, the Old Testament, and they liked Hebrew as a sacred tongue. That biblical Hebrew was seen as somehow good and holy by the Protestant establishment. Aramaic, not as important. So in a British congregation, which is authentically British, we'll emphasize the Bible and Hebrew. So even the Kaddish was in Hebrew. What about prayers for the restoration of Zion? This is a reformist congregation, so we've been speaking for months about how they get rid of Shivat Zion. What is this shul going to do? Get rid of it or keep it? Keep it. Why keep it? Because it's in the Bible. Because you can't deny that time and again in the prophetic writings and in the Ketuvim, it talks all about Shivat Zion and Kibbutz Galuyot. So although it may be problem politically, it's insensitive in terms of civic participation, they don't worry about that. They care about the Bible says we're going to return to Zion, so we'll keep the petitions for the return to Zion.
They say brachos king and queen.
Oh, absolutely, sure. Yeah. Yeah. There is a thought like that. There's also a thought that the Messiah won't come unless the Jews are exiled to every part of the world. Right. So, now, by Menashe ben Israel with Cromwell, yeah. Now, the abolition of the second day of Yom Tov Sheni Shel Galuyot, is what led to the real schism. This shul, this breakaway shul, it was causing trouble because it broke the bylaws. The bylaws did not allow for breakaways and could lead to excommunication, macherim, just for that alone, even without doctrinal deviation. However, the big reason why they were put with the X across them, no good, is because they abolished the second day Yom Tov. Why did they abolish it? So, of course, if we're being strict biblicalists, it's Baal Tosif. It's against the biblical calendar, holiday calendar. It's Baal Tosif. But there are other reasons. There are two other very important reasons why they got rid of the second day Yom Tov. One, because repetition reduces the emotional impact of the liturgy. When you say something twice, It's not the same thing as if you only said it once. You only have Yom Kippur once. You only have Nila once.
We feel that when we have the second Seder.
Right, the second Seder, people get tired of it. You know, I just had the Korach and the Maror yesterday. Why do I need to do it again? But if you have it only one time, it's real special. The other factor is, and American Jews can appreciate this, you have to take off too many days from work. And if this is at a time when British Jews are seeking to enter into the public service, as barristers or maybe even judges, who knows what, public officials, they cannot just take off so many days when otherwise business is being conducted. So you have to limit the impact of religious observance on your work schedule.
Hefsid Merubah, yeah.
This was the time in the 19th century throughout Europe when the rabbinate had the power of excommunication?
No, that's long gone.
Oh, it was? Because I thought you were talking about 1830s.
Yeah, that's long gone already by the 1830s.
What year is this?
This is 1840.
Okay.
I'll
assume that the rabbinate in England did not look favorably upon this breakaway, right?
Okay, so I'm going to talk about that now.
Translate into marriages and the course.
Okay, so that's a big issue. We're going to discuss that now. Moses Montefiore, as the president of the Board of Deputies of British Jews, pressured the rabbis, Meldola, the Sephardic, and Solomon Herschel, the Ashkenazi, into excommunicating this bunch of reformers, this West London synagogue. And because he was the president of the Board of Deputies, it was his prerogative to issue a license for the secretary of every congregation to register marriages, and he refused to grant that. So this congregation was not an official Jewish congregation in the eyes of the law, until an act of parliament in 1857 explicitly included them as being an official congregation. So for 17 years, their guy, David Wolf Marx, could not officiate at weddings, or they could not be registered as legal weddings.
So you just said there was no excommunication.
No. In England, there was a curiosity of the law that said the Board of Deputies determines who is recognized as an official clergyman or official synagogue, and if that recognition is withheld, then the law of the land doesn't recognize any solemnizing of acts by that group.
It wasn't geared toward individuals, it was geared toward the... to a kahila.
Correct. Okay. You can do a religious service whenever you want. The question is it recognized in the civil law? Oh, so would the other shuls cooperate with them and give them the satisfaction? So the answer to that is there were strings attached. Yeah.
Did England require everyone to identify with having a religion?
No.
You could have faded
off completely, but these people were not interested in that. These people had a fairly robust Jewish identity. In a few moments, we'll get to the liberal Jews who have garnished, and they really could have just faded away. Yeah.
You don't really need a rabbi to get married, you just need two Adam.
That's true, but people want to go to their clergyman, and if they're affiliated with the congregation, and think that it's just as legitimate as somebody else. Okay. Now, yes, in German states you had no choice but to be affiliated, not in England. Okay. When the Cheirem was issued in 1842, it was not so easy to sever the social ties between the various camps. After all, these people are married to each other, they're cousins with each other, brothers and sisters. It's no simple thing. It's a small group. You're not going to just cut them off completely. So a caution was sent out, an azhara was sent out by the chief rabbis to the various congregations, warning them not to be involved with the West London Synagogue and not to use their prayer book. So this azhara was not well received. It was rejected and sent back by the communities in Manchester and Liverpool, and the community in Plymouth burned it. So they didn't want to hear about these cheirims and these azharot. We're all Jews, leave us alone, let the people do whatever they want.
They could still date their girls.
Okay, so let's see.
The group that burned the
Yeah. Didn't burn the sitter, burned the azhara. The warning, that not to use the sitter. Okay, so Nathan Marcus Adler, who was hired as chief rabbi in 1844, replacing Salman Herschel, he would never step foot in the West London synagogue, not even for ceremonial occasions. It's like if, you know, the Reform rabbi's mother or father passes away, and he's sitting shiva, and they have the funeral in the shul, and the Orthodox rabbi won't go into the Temple Israel or wherever to go to the funeral. If you do that, it causes ill will and trouble. I mean, when Louis Marshall died in 1929, the Ramaz himself went to that funeral at Temple Emmanuel and sat in the front row. 1929, Temple Emmanuel, Ramaz. But Nathan Marcus Sadler would not step foot into the West London synagogue under any condition. And if there was going to be an intermarriage between a girl from the reformist congregation and a boy from the Orthodox, he would not solemnize the marriage unless he extracted a concession that the girl from the reformed synagogue would lead an Orthodox life and go to the Orthodox shul. How do you like that?
That's Catholicism. You have to sign an agreement.
It's playing hardball. Okay.
By the way,
not well.
By the way, it's not enforceable.
No, of course not. But it's social pressure, strong social pressure.
Yeah.
Adler was a German rabbi who was hired on condition that he learned to speak English within 1 year to counteract the deficiencies of Herschel's rabbinate before him. And he was the chief rabbi from 1844 until his death in 1891, although he retired in 1879 and his son Hermann Adler took over. Yeah.
Did the creation and existence of that West London congregation make West London now a more robust Jewish community?
Well, people were moving there anyway, just because for socioeconomic reasons, that's where they go. It's just nice that they now have a shul to go to as well. Okay, now, the West London Synagogue was known as the West London Synagogue of British Jews. But don't let the term British Jews fool you. It was not in any way saying that we are British as opposed to Jewish national. They're not like the German reformers who want to divorce themselves completely from so-called Am Yisrael and be people of a Mosaic faith. That's not the intent here. The intent by saying British Jews is that we're neither German nor Spanish Portuguese, but rather the minhag of this country is what we're doing right here. We're forgetting about the minhagim of the past, or we're borrowing from them, and we're creating our own, which is indigenous to England, to the community of British Jews. So in that respect, it's a nice thing. Okay. What kind of changes happened in that synagogue? Well, not much after the early phases, because some of those Jews were very traditional in personal observance, and the conservative element in the next generation served as a front against any radical change, any radical reform. So by 1859, what did they have? They had an organ. They had no prayers for Korbanot. There was a mixed choir, and there were a few English prayers. But other than that, the liturgy was the same as the Orthodox. And it was separate seating, and it had the flavor of a real shul. It didn't feel like a church. Huh?
Microphone?
In 1859, there were no microphones, and there was no mixed seating. So it wasn't all that far away from a decorous Orthodox synagogue.
So from the ambience of an organ played, the organ messes it all up.
It messes it all up, but otherwise, you couldn't tell the difference.
Okay. But the organ was on Shabbat itself, not
yes, Shabbat. The organ was on Shabbat itself. Yeah.
Did they have mapitzes when they had separate seating?
The answer is there was a balcony, so I don't know if mechitza is all that relevant, because there was a balcony. When we get to the liberals, there was no mechitza and no balcony. Okay, so ultimately, the reform movement, capital R reform, was not much of a success in England. They had their shul in West London, and they had a synagogue in Manchester. But beyond that, they really were not so successful. And the reason why not is because the Orthodox won. And the Orthodox won by basically adopting the Reformed position, by having a decorous service, by making the chief rabbi into the Jewish Archbishop of Canterbury. But the United Synagogues were not Shtiblach of Eastern Europe, or even the Yekka synagogues of the 18-teens, but rather they were big cathedral places where the ministers, and not rabbis, but ministers wearing canonicals, giving English language sermons with choirs. It was aesthetically very pleasing. And as for the piety of the individual Jews who went, don't ask questions. That's the basic thrust. Don't ask too many questions about personal piety. There's just decorous orthodoxy in the synagogue. And if you have that, you don't need a big and vibrant reform alternative. Now, the reform movement denied that it was a neo-Karaite movement. David Wolf Marx, who didn't believe in saying brachas over Mikra Megillah and Hanukkah candles, you could argue his focus exclusively on the Bible at the expense of the Talmud makes him into a Karaite. He would deny that. He would say that he respects the long scope of Jewish history and biblical interpretation as done in the rabbinic writings. It's just that they don't have a veto power over him, that he's also interpreting, but he's not a Karaite. When England turned away from scripturalism towards biblical criticism, this kind of religion no longer is as enticing as it might have been. But the other issue is, there are Jews who don't like the fact that even the Reform movement is too close to Orthodoxy, and they want something further to the left. Always to the left. Okay, so who are these people? Well, there are acculturated Jews who now are not troubled by the Talmud and the Halachic codes. That's irrelevant to them. They're even troubled by the Bible itself. Judaism itself is a problem to them. They were secularists who were drifting to the periphery, but who had yet to cross over to another affiliation, so therefore they were nominally still within Judaism. They weren't doing anything Jewish, but they were nominally still within Judaism. And the spiritual progenitor of liberal Judaism, as it came to be known, liberal with a capital L, was Claude Goldschmidt Montefiore, the grandnephew of Moses Montefiore. He was born in 1858, died in 1938, was independently wealthy because he was descended from the Goldschmidt and Montefiore families, number one, and also because his brother died young and was a rich guy and he inherited his brother's estate. Okay.
So was it his grandfather that was the brother of Moses Montefiore?
Yes.
The one
yes.
who was
I believe
left
so.
Out.
I believe so, yeah. Okay. He wanted to universalize Judaism by removing its narrower elements that prevented Jews from accepting truths from beyond the pale of Judaism. In other words, if there is truth to be gleaned from the New Testament or from other sources that seem verboten to a traditional Jew, let us be open to accepting those truths. He also is a staunch believer in accepting the postulates of biblical criticism without hesitation, and also unflinchingly accepting the conclusions of science, even if they run counter to traditional belief. He believes that the final authority is the individual human and not the text, and therefore it doesn't matter who wrote the Bible. We need not get all and up in arms whether Moses wrote the Bible or there are multiple authors, you know, a la documentary hypothesis. His exact quote was, "The book is not good because it is from God. It is from God insofar as it is good." Whoa. Now what does that mean?
All good things come from God.
It means we determine what we like and we don't like. And if we like it, it's divine. And if we don't like it, that aspect of this sacred book is not divine. Okay.
And who's the we? Is everybody, does that mean that everybody does what they want to do? Or is there a cohesive unity?
So there's certainly no Shulchan Aruch for liberal Judaism. And they're going to do away with much of ceremonial practice. But you could say, well, is it everyone a man for himself, or is there some sort of liberal theologian who gets to determine these things? That was never fully clarified, nor could it be clarified. Okay. He said, if I were determining what is going to go in the synagogue, if we were to have a holy ark, instead of putting the Pentateuch, the five books of Moses, in the ark, instead I would take out the Torah and put in Amos, Hosea, and Isaiah. Amos, Hosea, and Yeshaya. Why? Because what are the great spiritual works of the Hebrew tradition? The prophets, the moralistic prophets, not Mosaic law with its emphasis on ritual purity and priestly caste and all sorts of ceremonies that nobody wants to do anymore.
Yeah, but the prophets had a lot of venomous things to say about the Torah.
That's true in some instances, especially regarding those who were the direct enemies of Israel, like Edom or Ashur or whatever, but on the other hand, you have some of the moralistic prophets who speak about an end of day scenario of the sheep lying with the lamb, and that Kodosh Ve'Tevel, all the people, the inhabitants of the earth, coming to Mount Zion to worship in unity. So that's what he likes.
But the man in the street likes the Old Testament. Who likes the prophets? They're boring and they're long and they're,
you've been influenced by 20th century American Jewish day school and a Talmud Torah experience.
Damn straight. No,
okay.
But I mean,
yeah.
And we had mentioned that in the past.
Yes, you're right. From the perspective of what we experienced, yes, you're right. But from a 19th century enlightened British Jew, I'm not surprised that he likes the Nevi'im more than the Chamisha Chumshei Torah. Okay, now then the question is, what does he hope to accomplish by opening the borders of Judaism to outside influence, outside literary and spiritual influence? Well, he sought to neutralize the attractiveness of Unitarianism and theism. But then the question then is, well, why not just become a Unitarian?
And some did.
And some did. Plenty did, yeah, sure. I mean, it's the least problematic of all the things to be a Meshuman for, but it's still, you're a Meshuman if you're a Unitarian.
The attraction that they had was that they didn't have a deification.
Of Jesus, right, and there's no Trinity.
The crucifix and
all the iconography and problematic theology associated with Trinitarianism is gone. And so can a Jew be a Unitarian? Yeah, sure, except that
ethical culture
is the other option, which was in America, New York.
No mitzvahs to do.
So why not become a Unitarian? So Montefiore's response would be that he believed there's one mitzvah that we have, one mitzvah that's specific to Jews, and that is a divine mission to carry the universal message to humanity. Meaning it's the responsibility of Jews to retain their separatist identity for the purpose not of putting on tefillin and keeping kosher, but of projecting that message of the one God and of the moral God and of moral humanity. So, basically, yes. As my congregant, Cynthia Ozick, once said, universalism is the Jew's particularism. And she's right. Among progressive Jews, universalism is their brand of particularism. What is our goal as Jews in this world? To project the image of universalism. Of course, the problem is, how do you do that without compromising your own identity? And the answer is, it's not easy. Basically, you can't. You can't sustain this kind of liberal Judaism for multiple generations, and invariably there's intermarriage, and there's apostasy, and there's indifference. But for Montefiore, he believed you could do it. That liberal Judaism could be a real denomination and survive. Of course, in order to survive, he had to be a staunch opponent of what? Intermarriage. You can't intermarry. You can be as irreligious in the ceremonial sense as you would like, and certainly he was, but don't intermarry, because intermarriage is the death knell of any heterodox Judaism. And he's right. There's evidence, demographic evidence proves today. Huh? He lived until he was 80, yeah, until 1938. Right.
He must have been right.
Huh? Bris Mila, the answer to that is many of them did have Bris Mila, but it wasn't regarded as absolutely essential. Okay, so liberal Judaism is of Claude Montefiore, is reaching beyond the tradition, not out of a rejection of the tradition, but out of an attraction to broader horizons. This was an educated man, Cambridge, who saw the outside world and liked some of it and wanted to incorporate the better parts of that into his religious identity. What was his Jewish associations? Well, the answer is he went to the Hochschule in Berlin very briefly in the late 1880s to study for the Reform Rabbinate. Although he didn't complete his studies there, he was there for a few years, and he was tutored by none other than Solomon Schechter. Solomon Schechter, the great Romanian Jewish scholar who would go on to become the reader of rabbinics at Cambridge, and then the chancellor, the president of JTS in 1902. So he learned from some of the best, but whereas Schechter was a traditional Jew, Montefiore clearly was not. Okay. The other leading figures in liberal Judaism, the most important organizer was Lily Montagu. Lily Montagu was the first important woman in denominational life in the modern period. And her article in 1899 in the Jewish Quarterly Review was titled Spiritual Possibilities in Judaism Today, in which she got started this liberal movement. Her father was an Orthodox Jew, Lord Swaveling, and he was actually the founder of in 1887 of the Federation of Congregations, which was more frum than the United Synagogue. The father was an old line Orthodox Jew, but she found no inspiration in the Orthodox Synagogue, so she wanted to have this alternative. And the alternative was called the Jewish Religious Union, JRU. It began not as a synagogue, but as an opportunity for Jews to get together for devotional services. The initial one was held on October 1st, 1902, on a Saturday afternoon at 3:30 p.m. to allow for those who were working Saturday morning, obviously, but wanted to have the traditional Sabbath and not a Sunday Sabbath. And the men and women sat together. The men had optional head covering, and the prayers were largely in English. Basically, this was not a synagogue service. It was a devotional exercise. It was designed to get people who were distant from Jewish life to have some Yiddishkeit, something. Okay. But although her desire was to not have a separatist movement and to not even have their own synagogue, but to just rent space from an existing synagogue for this alternative service, the chief rabbis were not cooperating with her. Hermann Adler wanted none of this and refused any help. And so by 1909, they recognized that they had to have their own synagogue. And so the JRU, the Jewish Religious Union, which began as a cross-section of personalities with different theological viewpoints, became a very ultra-left group that had its own synagogue called the Liberal Jewish Synagogue. Well, who's the rabbi? The rabbi they hire is an American musmach, a Lithuanian Jew by birth, but a musmach of HUC, Hebrew Union College, Israel Matuk. Israel Matuk was about as far left as you could get in the classical reform vein, M-A-T-T-U-C-K, Matuk. And he produced a sitter, a very important sitter, which was used in many reform congregations. He was a classical reformer in the sense of being a chazer fresser. You know, he ate treif and believed in not observing the ceremonial law, and he would marry women without a get. All right, that's an important one. So the liberal synagogue in England had no counterpart in Europe other than the Reform Gemeinde in Berlin, Samuel Holdheim's synagogue in Berlin. Other than that, Reform in Europe was basically moderate. Okay, Reform in America was extreme. We haven't discussed that yet. Over the next few months, we'll get to that. So liberal Judaism in England is the functional equivalent to Reform Judaism in America, and Reform Judaism in England is the functional equivalent to like conservative Judaism in America. So don't let the terminology confuse you. Reform here is not Reform there. Oh, well, Reform conservative Judaism was 30, 40 years ago, correct. Okay. She was neutral on Zionism towards negative.
Really?
Yes. Neutral to negative on Zionism. But now let me read to you from the writings of Claude Goldschmidt Montefiore on liberal Judaism and on Zionism. And you'll see where he got everything wrong. Okay. So on the topic of liberal Judaism, he wrote after a few decades, "Large and important is the work which liberal Judaism has accomplished." So he's tooting his own horn. "If we recognize that its own edges are still rough, though less rough than the edges of the Old Testament." That's a chutzpah. It's saying that if there are problems in my style of religion, it's still better than what the Bible had to say. "We yet believe it is capable of something even more." Okay. "Liberal Judaism has taken up again on distinctive Jewish lines the teachings of the prophets. It has, we may say, truly say, put the prophets in a new position in relation to each other. It has religiously emancipated women." Very important. Liberal Judaism said that men and women are equal in terms of liturgical participation. And Lily Montagu was a lay preacher who got up in front of the congregation. This is her wearing a canonicals. So she was half a rabbi, practically. Okay, "It has emancipated women. It has become a religion suited and fitted for Western world." So Montefiore felt that liberal Judaism could have become the dominant religion in the Western world. It could take over Christianity as the religion for the West. "It has attempted to denationalize Judaism and to universalize it. It has fashioned or adapted new ideas of much moment and significance concerning revelation and inspiration, as well as new ideas concerning authority and freedom." Here's a key line. It has boldly and openly faced new conclusions of history and criticism and sought to find new adjustments to them. It has attempted to fashion Judaism which can look science in the face without flinching, which is independent of the dates and authorship of the biblical books and the miracles recorded in them. What he's saying is, too many rabbis, whether modern Orthodox or middle-of-the-road non-Orthodox, become obsessed with the dating of the various biblical books and authorship of these books and determining the validity of them, the divinity of them. He says, we don't worry about these things. That's not on our agenda. We read the book for what it says. And if what it says is virtuous and good, then we'll adopt it into our lives. And if it's not, then we put it aside. And we don't worry about what year it was written, under inspiration, or who wrote it. Irrelevant. Okay. Liberal Judaism seeks to fashion a Judaism which shall be broad and humble enough to believe in its own truths, own treasures, can be enriched and added to from the truths and treasures which may have been vouchsafed to leaders other than the Jewish teachers. In other words, we can read beyond our canon into the canon of other religions and see what good they have. It does not attempt to fashion a Judaism which shall be a mere medley of pretty notions gathered from every source, but it attempts to make its own doctrine still richer and fuller and no less harmonious and consistent by selected garnerings from without. So far that we can learn from Jesus and even Paul, we learn from Jews and not from aliens. The Jewish Jesus and the Jewish Paul. Now, he should have said Saul, because Saul of Tarsus is the Jew. Paul is the Shagetz. Okay. All right. Now let's go to his relationship to Zionism. Yes, they're the same person, but right. Saul of Tarsus is the Jew. Paul is the other. Okay. Who changed? I don't know. I wasn't there.
Is he hoping to proselytize by example?
I don't think so. However, in light of intermarriage increasing among the elite of society, it's inevitable that at some point Jews are going to stop apostatizing to the Anglican Church and hope that the Christian becomes a Jew. What kind of Jew are they going to become? Not an Orthodox one, not even a Reform one, but a liberal one. It's a very important question. How do you determine religion? So a great scholar once told me, religion follows the wealthier spouse. Whenever you have intermarriage, it follows the wealthier spouse. So if Jews are social climbers, then on their way up, they're going to be a mishumadim to the Anglican Church. But once they get to the top, and now the Gentile who's improving their station in life, they're going to need to become a Jew if the Jew cares enough to make that happen. And they'll become a liberal Jew. Okay. Now let's go to the issue of Herzl. So Montefiore met Herzl, and years later, he had the following to say. We're going to run a little late, but it's worth reading this. Okay. On a visit to England, Herzl asked me for an interview and made the request that I should become his English Zionist lieutenant. By every means possible, by flattery, by cajolery, argument, threat, he sought to gain his end. In other words, the Zionists will stop at nothing to get what they want. And I admit that so charming was the man, so powerful and winning his personality, that I had to pull myself together to keep straight and to refuse him. As for his theory, it was this. He compared the Jews in various countries to water in a sponge. A sponge can hold a certain, very limited quantity of water. Pour a little more water into the sponge and water trickles out at the other end. He compared the Jews in various countries in the world to water in the sponge. The countries of the world can endure a certain number, a percentage of them. Put more in the country and you trickled out anti-Semitism. Okay, so that was Herzl trying to win over Montefiore by saying that Jews can't be overrepresented in the diaspora. They have to have a place of their own. Otherwise, anti-Semitism will never come to an end. Okay. On the Jewish side, the mandate led to an enormous increase in development of Jewish nationalism. On the Gentile side, to an increase in anti-Semitism, increasing misapprehension and denial of the old Jewish position, of my once ordinary, now alas, diehard position. So he's writing this in the 1930s, saying, I opposed the British mandate with all my might, but my side lost, and the mandate increased Jewish nationalistic fervor, but it also increased among the Gentiles anti-Semitism. So it wasn't worth it. And my position is now an old, forgotten, diehard position. Everybody's in favor of Zionism. I'm one of the last holdouts. Okay, then he says like this. You see before you a disillusioned old man, a sad and embittered old man, but yet not a hopeless old man, for he still believes in God. He refuses to bow to the knee to the fashionable Zionist Baal. Whoa, oy vey. He refuses to succumb to Jewish nationalism on the one hand, or Gentile antisemitism on the other, even though these powerful forces powerfully react upon one another. He is an extremist, a diehard fanatic, if you will, but he has not lost his faith. His old ideal of the Englishman of the Jewish faith shall yet, as he believes, prevail. So here in 1937, he's still, with Hitler on the scene, with anti-Semitism, with Zionism, with appeal commission, with all this stuff going on, he's remembering an old encounter with Herzl and saying, you know what, I'm still an old-fashioned British Jewish anti-Zionist who believes in liberal Judaism. And I'm not going to give up. I'm going to go down with the ship, you know.
One year later, he died.
Yeah.
One year later, he died.
So we see that even though history moves in a certain direction, and people live long lives and they experience changes, sometimes they refuse to give up old dreams. And his dream was of an acculturated, prestigious, elite Jew who has this belief in God and not much else and calls that his liberal Judaism, which rejects nationalism. And although the world moves in a totally other direction, he won't give up that faith. That's liberal Judaism. It plays a largely insignificant role in the history of the broader history of Judaism. Reform in America is the equivalent of that, but reform was successful. Liberal Judaism never was. Okay. It still exists. The synagogue still exists, but it doesn't play much of a role in anything. Okay, we'll stop here.